When you read the obituaries in your local paper, some of the life stories really stand out. One of the obituaries from 2019 that revealed a truly exceptional life story was about a guy who had been with the Kansas City Symphony Orchestra for 64 years. He was a violinist, and when he joined what was then called the Philharmonic, he joined as a concertmaster, making him the youngest concertmaster in the United States. He was born in Romania in 1931. He was Jewish, and his story intersects dramatically with 20th century geopolitics, labor camps, ghettos, falsified visas, even a special concert set up just for American consuls to help get this guy to Juilliard. But I don't want to be the one to introduce him by name. I'm going to let a live broadcast from the 1950s handle that instead.
Kansas City Life has the great pleasure in presenting for his third year on the Kansas City Hour, the exciting young concertmaster of the Philharmonic, Tiberius Klausner.
Tiberius Klausner. Here he is, the exciting young concertmaster playing violin with the Philharmonic. I'm Gina Kaufman. We're going to hear the Tiberius Klausner story now, but we also want to hear the stories of people you lost this year. Share them with the rest of us. Tell us what they meant to you or your community, or just tell the story for what it is because it matters. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. And now, my guest for this conversation is someone who worked with Tiberius Klausner for a long time. He's a broadcast professional living in New York. He's hosted a couple of different radio programs, but he's also performed with a number of symphonies as a conductor and trombonist. And Bill, that's how you and Tiberius crossed paths, right?
Correct. Yeah, I remember I didn't meet Tibor until 1986 when I first came to conduct the Kansas City Symphony. But I'd known of him before because I'd been around the Marlboro Festival, which is a great festival up in southern part of Vermont, started by Rudolph Suskin. And Tiberius had played there as a youngster. And I'm now talking about probably late 50s. And people remember him. Even this summer, I was up there doing something with Arnold Steiner, and people were still talking about Tibor. That's 50 years and more ago.
And that, is that what how people referred to him if they knew him?
Sure. Yep. I never heard it. Well, it's, you know, like, I'm William only if I'm in trouble in school. Otherwise, I'm Bill. And it's, and the same with Tiberius, which is a great old name, but people just called him simply Tibor. He himself referred to himself that way.
I understand you were kind of a dynamic duo.
Well, he was wonderful because he brought such background to the orchestra. When he came there in the 50s, he'd just come from studying, well, in Europe to begin with, and then he went from Romania to Budapest, I think, and then to Paris, and then to Juilliard, where he studied with the great Ivan Galamian, who recommended him to the Kansas City Symphony as his concertmaster. And Tibor had all of this background, and not only that, I mean, skill. I mean, he could show any fiddle player what we needed to do, which was very helpful when we were working together. You see, an orchestra is like it's like this weird hybrid animal. It's really sort of like a huge thoroughbred with 100 different spirits in it. And everyone thinks he or she knows exactly what to do, and no one else knows very much what to do. So the whole trick is to get everyone to agree somehow. And Tibor was invaluable in helping us find a unanimity of voice.
I've read this man's obituary, and it made me very, very sorry that I had never met him while he was alive. But I am happy to talk to you about him now. The first detail about his life that intrigued me, according to his obituary, is that he fell in love with the violin, not as a student of classical music, but as a four-year-old in Romania watching gypsy musicians passing through his town.
Well, to tell you the truth, Tibor grew up ethnic Hungarian Jewish, in a part that had been a part of Transylvania, which had been part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire for a very long time. But after the First World War, that country got broken up. So now these Hungarian families found that they were called Romanian. And the Romanians are big on gypsies, lots of gypsy influence. And a lot of the greatest of the gypsy fiddlers go there. And you can imagine a four-year-old hearing this guy play out of his mind. The gypsies seemed to make everything up. They seemed to float on air when they played the violin. And Tibor said, "Mom, I think I want to try to do that.
And it took a while before he was able to give it a try, but he remained obsessed, as at least that was my read of this story.
Yeah. I knew that he had heard first a gypsy fiddler, and it was about a year or two later that he actually got a violin and began to take lessons and practice, but he picked up in a hurry. He had a wonderful sense of pitch, wonderful sense of style, and a beautiful sound.
He was born in 1931 in Eastern Europe. Mm-hmm. We've touched on that, with World War II on the horizon. That's the part we haven't touched on. He was Jewish, and this collision of his own ethnic identity, his own religious identity, with geopolitics of that time determined the course of his childhood. What do you know about that part of his story?
Well, 1948 is a big year. I mean, 1945 is the end of the war to begin with. And at that point, the United States and the Soviet Union were firm allies. It's the only way we were able to defeat Hitler's armies. But by 1948, the Cold War had started, and the Russians kind of took over Czechoslovakia and Hungary and Romania, and they made it very hard for people to move inside the country, much less get out of the country. And that was Tibor's bit, because he had to get out of Romania in order to make the next steps as a violinist.
Well, the story of how he got out of Romania and got from Romania to Kansas City has lots of twists and turns. But when the war ended, he was 14 years old, right? And the mayor of the town where his family resettled happened to hear him playing the violin. And that's great. The person who was determined to get him out.
Wow, I didn't know that part of the story. That's great to hear. You've been doing some good research.
Well, the obituary is extensive. Mm-hmm. What was your understanding of just that getting out piece of it and how that affected him?
I knew he had some connection with Budapest as well in Hungary. But then he came to the Paris Conservatoire and did very, very well. I don't know exactly how he got the exit visa, but there he was.
That mayor. The mayor of the town he ended up in after the war heard him play the violin and was responsible for getting him that exit visa.
For so many of the old musicians that we used to remember, a wonderful pianist named Rudolf Firkuzny, who was Czech, told me that he had broken his ankle in 1948 trying to do flip-flops coming down from a concert hall, trying to catch up with his acrobatic friend. I said, because I broke my ankle, I couldn't go back to Czechoslovakia, and that's the only reason I wasn't stuck there when the Iron Curtain came down. So I think a lot of people had stories like that. But with Tibor, it was really great because he went from Paris then to Juilliard in New York City, and he was there a couple of years, and Galamian, his great teacher, recommended him to the Tanglewood Festival, which is the Boston Symphony's summer home. And Tibor became the concertmaster, the leader of all these whiz kid fiddle players in America, at which time I'm not sure Tibor had a lot of English. He spoke, as a kid, I know, German, French, Hungarian, probably Yiddish, but I think English was always a little bit on the edge of what he could do.
Well, conveniently, he used an instrument to communicate largely in his profession.
Yeah. But I remember when I first started, I had to learn what the word was, V-O-T, which most of us say, vot. That's Tibor saying, what do you mean, maestro, vot? And when she did that, because Tibor, it could sound like an old bear, but he was so warm and had such a great sense of humor.
There was one other story from kind of his early life in this obituary that I wanted to ask you about. And this might not be something he ever talked about, and of course, I'm getting it secondhand, but... So my understanding is that when he was accepted into Juilliard, there was some kind of issue with his nationality and he couldn't get a student visa. And this is something that piqued my interest because the obituary went on to explain that a special concert was set up with the whole idea being to get American consuls in the audience.
Well, it got him into there. And in fact, it got him into the U.S. Army. He served for 6 months or so and then served for about 6 years down at Fort Leonard Wood in the reserve. So he became a very American Hungarian violinist.
He came straight out of Juilliard. He is involved in Tanglewood, but he pretty much comes straight to the Kansas City Philharmonic as the youngest concertmaster in the country, 23 years old. Quickly, can you explain what is a concertmaster and how big a deal was this?
Yeah, I mentioned that the orchestra is this strange thoroughbred amalgam of 80 to 100 free spirits. All of these musicians are so smart. They're so bloody intelligent. They are incredibly temperamental in a good way. They really love what they're doing so much and they're passionate about it. But with the string players in particular, every one of them in your orchestra started off thinking, I'm not going to play in an orchestra. I'm going to be standing in front playing the solo concerto in front of the orchestra. And in fact, for some of them, they feel like, oh, I didn't quite get there. I have to play in the second violin section of this orchestra. So that you can have to sort of seduce these terrific artists into coming along with a single idea. And Tieber was very, very helpful in doing that.
And that's the job of a concertmaster?
It's the job of the conductor, the concertmaster. And in the long run, it's the job of every person in the orchestra, because an orchestra is not a bunch of individuals. It's a unit. And if you're playing as a bunch of individuals, it'll sound like hell. But if you all get in together, it makes a sound that's glorious like nothing else on earth.
So he was a concertmaster and violinist, and that's typical, like typically how it works, right?
Concertmaster is just a title. They don't use the same thing. In England, for example, the concertmaster is called simply the leader or a leader, and people have different languages. For example, in France, they don't talk of the conductor. They say chef d'orchestre, as if he's a chef of the orchestra.
Which and, makes sense.
Yeah, but the concertmaster is the principal of all of the violinists. He sits at the front of the orchestra on the outside. You see, there's a sort of a violinists sit in pairs. They share one music stand. And the outside player is sort of the more senior and more respected. And the one who sits on the outside and the very first row is the concertmaster.
So what? He's 23 years old doing that. Would that still be unusual today?
Sure. It's not unheard of. Man, I love human beings. But the talent, the way it gets spread out, is not predictable. It's not always, it doesn't seem fair, but some people get a whole lot of talent early on. Tieber was one of them. There are many of them, though, around. I mean, some spectacular players. I'm thinking of Paul Neubauer, a buddy of mine, was principal violist of the New York Philharmonic when he was about 21 or 22 also. So it can happen. But the main thing is that, okay, now you got the job. You played better than anyone else on the audition. Now what do you do? Because you have to work with human beings. You have to sort of
human beings who might be jealous of you, I would think, in that situation.
Let's say that potential exists, but the whole job of playing in an orchestra is to knock the edges off those kind of rough parts of people's personality and get them to play together. And so the conductor can do that. The individuals in the orchestra have to do that if they're going to play and enjoy. See, playing in the orchestra can be the best job in the world, or it's possible you could make yourself miserable if you are jealous. But, man, that's no way to go through life.
What did Tiberius Klausner think of Kansas City, this worldly guy whose journey started off in Romania before Paris and New York? I'm curious about what this place looked like and felt like to him in the 1950s.
That's a good question. And what I know about this, curiously enough, when I was in Kansas City, my sweetheart, Coronel, is a great singer. She knew all the old-time jazzers. I mean, there are lots of them. Jay McShann was still around. Sonny Kenner was still around. Some of these old characters, Speedy, you know, they had these guys went back to the Count Basie Band and before. So I knew both the classical and the jazz guys. I think Kansas City has always been the most appealing city. I love Kansas City. People outside the Midwest think probably Kansas City is just this flat thing. They get it mixed up with the prairies of western Kansas. It isn't. It's hilly. It's beautiful. It's got a couple rivers running through it. It's got more fountains than any city in the world except Rome. And it has an interesting combination of people. Lots of different people together, black and white and Asian and people from all over the world. And they make a very, easily identifiable. You know, a Kansas City accent, and I watched the way the Kansas City folks root like crazy for their football teams and their baseball teams. No matter whether they're winning or not, they still love the Royals, they still love the Chiefs, and they still love the orchestras in Kansas City. But in the late 60s, the old Philharmonic fell on hard times. A lot of orchestras were in financial trouble at that time, and that's the period when Tieber bailed out. He said, I don't need this. This is going downhill in a bad way. I don't like what's happening. And he was playing in a very good duo with a wonderful pianist named Richard Cass. They played concerts all over, made wonderful recordings. He said, I'm going to go on teaching at the conservatory and playing with my friend Richard, and I don't need this hassle of the orchestra. It's starting to break up. Well, it did break up eventually, and the old Philharmonic folded in 82. And some very wise people, there were some Kansas City mainstays, people like Crosby Kemper, Don Hall, H&R Block, Paul Henson, prevailed upon Tieber to come back in and be the mainstay of this newly formed orchestra called the Kansas City Symphony. And that's about where I come onto the picture, because I showed up 4 years later when they made me their first music director. And I was so glad to see such an accomplished, famous, and really capable concertmaster as my partner.
You know, we've talked a lot about him being this prodigy as a young musician, but what was special about him as a mentor to other musicians? I would think that's what he would become as he developed into this elder with the symphony.
I think from the beginning he was a good teacher, and maybe a great, great teacher. I used to like see these at our concerts. I'm thinking when we were still playing at the Lyric Theater at that time, these beautiful young women would show up backstage, and they hadn't come to see me. I thought, hey, man, I'm the conductor. You didn't come to see me? No, they said, we want to see Tibor. He's our old teacher. And these were women playing in the London Symphony Orchestra, the Amsterdam Concertgebouw, great orchestras in Europe, and they all back to see the great old teacher, the person who set them on the track. It was Tibor Klausner. He had such devoted pupils. And I think in the early years that I was there, a lot of the people in the orchestra had taken some lessons, or mostly lessons, with Tibor. So there was a kind of unanimity of thought that way, too.
You know, we have just a very little bit of time left, and I wonder if there's something he did or said, even just on a personal level, that sticks with you. It could be a little thing, just the thing that's playing in your film reel in your mind.
I accompanied him as a soloist many times, but one was really particular. I asked him if he had ever played the second Prokofiev violin concerto, which is very beautiful, but it's sort of very modern, at least the outside movements, the middle movements of the lullaby. And he said, oh, I've always wanted to do it. I said, well, let's do it next year. And we started to work on it. And we thought, you know what? We better give the audience a break. So after we play this sort of very modern sounding piece of music, Tibor said, may I play something really beautiful as an encore? And I said, yeah. And he played the Meditation from Thais. So he not only played the Prokofiev brilliantly, but then came around, turned on the stage, and I said, you tell them. He said, I am going to play the Meditation from Thais of Massenet. And then he just broke people's hearts.
Bill McLaughlin, thank you so much for remembering your late friend and colleague Tiberius Klausner with us today.
My pleasure, and my greetings to everybody in Kansas City. I love the town, I love the musicians, and I love everyone. Hey, in case you are, we used to do a lot of stuff together. Hang in there. Do great stuff.
We're trying. Thank you. Tiberius Klausner.
Thanks, Gina.
Thank you. Tiberius Klausner became the youngest concertmaster in the country when he joined the Kansas City Philharmonic in the 1950s. He died in October at 88. Our guest joined us from Chicago. They worked together here in town. Up next, trying to get out of Dodge, you're not alone. We're back. This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and lately we've been listening to Season 2 of My Fellow Kansans, hosted by my colleague Jim McLean with the Kansas News Service. This season of the podcast is all about the survival of small towns in the state, and this week we'll conclude with the final episode about one of the most famous small towns anywhere, the small town synonymous with all small towns, Dodge City.
Stay tuned for scenes from next week's Gunsmoke.
If there's one Kansas town that pretty much everyone's heard of, it's Dodge City. It's the star of a Wild West narrative that sparked the imaginations of people around the globe. Stories of gunslingers, ranchers battling sodbusters, and the mercenary lawmen recruited to keep the peace. Wyatt Earp, Bat Masterson, and for two full decades on CBS, Gunsmoke's Marshal Matt Dillon.
And you take the rest of your men, and you get out of Dodge.
Those stories proved irresistible to old-time Hollywood.
Is the most spectacular world premiere ever given a motion picture.
Two of the biggest names from Hollywood's past, Errol Flynn and Olivia de Havilland, not only starred in the 1939 movie Dodge City, they traveled to Kansas for its premiere.
Hollywood, over 200 stars, studio executives, and newspaper men, headed by Errol Flynn, boarded the 14-car Santa Fe Dodge City special en route for the premiere celebration.
Without question, it was the glitziest day in Dodge's dusty, storied cowpoke history.
And Dodge City, a town of 10,000 people, was for the day the focal point of the entire Middle West.
In the 80 years since, Dodge has had its ups and downs. But now this small city is holding its own, better than most towns scattered across rural Kansas. It's nearly triple the size it was on the day it played host to Hollywood. That's largely because of the industrial meatpacking industry and a growing population of immigrants, drawn to work that offers at least an opening to the American middle class. That same draw also helps steady other nearby beef-packing hubs like Garden City and Liberal. But there are other reasons, too. other things happening that make people in Dodge City and the region just a tad more optimistic about their future. I'm Jim McLean, and this is My Fellow Kansans, a podcast from the Kansas News Service. Okay, so compared to lots of communities in Kansas, Dodge City is faring well. From 2000 to 2017, its population grew by almost 10%, and it's held pretty steady since. Immigration is the main reason, but there are others. The town is making a play to be the entertainment capital of the region, a region without much else to lure travelers off the highway. A couple of multi-million dollar projects anchor that effort, including one to gussy up the downtown historic district. When finished next year, it will feature a renovated replica of Old Front Street, with Miss Kitty's Long Branch Saloon and a bigger Boot Heel Museum. A casino that's been around for a while and a new distillery are also part of that effort.
It's the attraction of the Old West. It's sort of the mystique of what, you know, Dodge City was, the pop culture aspect of it that still resonates with the consumer of the Gunsmoke era.
By spiffing things up and trading even more heavily on their colorful past, city officials and a new group of entrepreneurs hope to double the town's tourist trade. But today, just as in its Wild West heyday, Dodge is above all else a cattle town. That's what struck Atlantic Magazine's James Fallows when he and his wife, Deborah, visited while researching Our Towns, their recent book about rural America. Here's Fallows reading a bit from that book.
Something like a quarter of the beef eaten anywhere in the United States comes through the feedlots, packing houses, and shipment centers of this corner of Kansas. The employees in these factories are nearly all immigrants. In the 1980s, a substantial number were recent arrivals from Vietnam. Now they're mainly Mexicans, or from Central and South America, plus an increasing number of Somalis and other Africans, plus some Southeast Asians and others.
Between them, Cargill and National Beef employ more than 5,000 people at massive slaughterhouses that dominate the east edge of town and foul the air over the entire city. The jobs at these plants are unpleasant and often dangerous.
Stun animals prior to slaughtering. Sever jugular veins to drain blood and facilitate slaughtering. Slit open, eviscerate, and trim carcasses. Saw, split, or scribe carcasses into smaller portions to facilitate handling.
But the relative good pay and benefits, Fallows says, are magnets for immigrants.
A man who had been a manager for a large packing house in the area told us, "I can tell you that no matter what wages you paid, you are not going to find any reasonable number of native-born Americans who will do these jobs," he said. He preferred not to be identified. "Your Anglo community is not going to work there, pretty much regardless of the wage. The economic and cultural survival of places like Dodge City and Garden City depends on immigrants, some of whom arrive legally and many of whom don't. There are some pockets of people here who are old school," the one-time packing house manager told us. "They'd like to take America back and so on. But by and large, people here, Anglo and Hispanic and otherwise, recognize that we're in this together. The immigrants are the engine that keeps this community alive."
Those workers have transformed Dodge City into what demographers call a minority-majority community. Today, about two-thirds of people in Dodge are Latino. Dodge's transformation, along with those of Garden and Liberal, are creating an ethnic mosaic in southwest Kansas, one that sets the region apart from other whiter rural places that hit their population peaks generations ago and have been hemorrhaging people ever since.
A lot of our western Kansas counties hit highs before the Dust Bowl. 1910 in Logan, Gove, 1910, Sheridan in 1930 at the start of the Dust Bowl. Where we see growth in western Kansas is in Hays with the around the university and around the packing plants and the cattle industry in southwest Kansas, which is where we see immigration.
That's Matt Sanderson, a rural sociologist and fifth-generation Kansan. He left the state for a stretch. Now he's back teaching at Kansas State, his alma mater. Sanderson sees all kinds of worrying trends for rural Kansas. Describing a color-coded map at a recent conference, he said big chunks of the state have lost so many people that they once again meet the definition of frontier, literally wilderness at the edge of a settled area.
These are projected population changes going forward into 2044. This is where we think we're going, right? And red is population loss. Blue is gain. The darker blue are larger gains. And that white is sort of in that middling category, right? That is not a healthy population profile. That scares, if you're interested in growth, this is a scary looking map. And I'm not one for hyperbole, but when I first saw this, I said, I work in a lot of Western Kansas areas with farmers. I do a lot of work. I have family out there. We're talking about over 2014 numbers. Wallace County is expected to lose half its population over 2014 by 2044. And in some of these places, we're talking about being able to fit counties into large lecture halls at Kansas State University.
Well, maybe just a touch of hyperbole, but still a pretty gloomy picture. That is, unless those hoping to revitalize rural Kansas can come up with ways, first, to stop people from leaving, and second, to attract newcomers.
I know this is hard to see, but
you don't have to see Sanderson's chart to understand it.
This is an important
just listen.
Point. There's only three ways that populations change. This is one of the most simple things I ever teach, right? So people either are born into a population and they add to the population. People die out of a population, they leave that population, or people move in and out. That's the only way you get change. So which one is going to be easiest for us to manipulate with policy? That's really the question.
It's possible, Sanderson says, to encourage people to have more children and give folks health care that extends their lives. But those things don't stop people from leaving. And that exodus, he says, is picking up pace.
So our net migration rate since 2010 has moved from roughly zero or slightly positive to negative every year since 2013. Every year since 2013, we've lost more people than have come into the state.
The steady loss of population, more people leaving than staying, is made worse, Sanderson says, by the fact that too many of us who remain in Kansas are past our prime working years, especially in the state's rural outposts.
So we're being hit by a couple things at once, an aging population and not a lot of in-migration.
Combined, those things drive a troublesome trend that suddenly worsened between 2010 and 2017.
In rural areas, lost 5% of their working age population on average in those 7 years. I had to check it, okay? It's a very large number. So this means we need to retain who we have and we need to attract newcomers. Those seem to be the policy levers, and those are both very closely tied, of course, to economic opportunity.
A shrinking and presumably less skilled workforce makes it much harder to crank up commerce. It's a classic rock and hard place problem for rural Kansas. But if there is an exception to the rule, it's Southwest Kansas, where immigrants actually drive growth. People like Ernesto de la Rosa. His family immigrated from Mexico in stages.
My two older brothers came to the United States as probably at the age of 15. They worked at the meat processing plants, and then we came to visit. Then we decided, after multiple times of visiting, we decided to stay in Dodge City.
And where did you come from?
I came from a state called Zacatecas, Mexico. Very kind of desert type, very rural as well.
Where is it located in Mexico?
Located probably the north central region in Mexico.
And it was rural too, you say?
Very rural. My dad comes from a background of farming, of cattle and such, and so very rural.
Well, so Dodge City is a natural destination for some.
It is very natural, very similar. Of course, you have better amenities. Maybe technology is a lot better here.
De La Rosa is now the assistant to the city manager. He landed in Dodge when he was 13 and watched the city's transformation.
I think it's, it came little by little. But I think the community has changed quite a bit in the sense that we're now 70% Latino or Hispanic. The sector, the labor, the labor demand obviously had to do a lot with it. I think for the most part, people embraced it. People welcomed the new immigrants, the new neighbors. But I think what the community was not ready for is the unique needs of such community, the needs of the immigrant labor, the needs of undocumented people, the needs of households of mixed status. And when I say that, we have a lot of households who the kids are American citizens, the parents are first-generation immigrants and are either in the process of adjusting status or undocumented. So you see a lot of that. And so I think the systems in place, such as local government, the school district, the county, and others, were not ready for those needs.
Specifically, how are they not ready?
Right now, what we struggle with is with the refugee community from African countries. You have a lot of dialects. We don't have an interpreter in our organization or department to be able to help that person because of a language barrier.
It must seem somewhat ironic to you.
Right.
Coming, you know, obviously the Hispanic Latino population in Dodge is big.
Right.
But it's not the only ethnic population of migrants
right.
here. I mean, you have the Somalis and you have a pretty large Asian population here as well.
And I think we've gone on to the point where with Latino or the Spanish language, we've are prepared and we know what to expect and we know what to do. With the other dialects, such as the Guatemalan, from the Guatemalan community, from the African countries, you struggle with those because you can't find that person who is either fluent on that dialect or fluent in English.
That does make integrating a population like right. that very difficult, doesn't it? I mean, yeah. there are just some yeah. basic yeah. things that they need and that you need from them.
Exactly. And that's just one side of the entire story. Aside from that, there are cultures within that community. There are traditions within that community that you must understand and you must learn how to address it. And then also you have to understand that just because they are Somali or just because they come from an African country, they also have different tribes. Oftentimes those tribes don't get along or don't speak to each other. So you have to understand those logistical
items. This sounds really hard to me.
Yes.
We are listening to the podcast My Fellow Kansans. It's the final episode of the season, and we are listening to it on KCUR's Central Standard. We'll pick right back up where we left off in just a minute. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we've been listening to My Fellow Kansans, Episode 6, Season 2. Before the break, host Jim McLean was talking to Ernesto de la Rosa, who's the assistant city manager for Dodge City, Kansas. They had been getting into some of the logistical challenges of incorporating new immigrants into city life, but some of the challenges are national, and Ernesto feels those challenges himself.
Here's something else that's hard. Ernesto's future in America is very much in doubt. He's here under rules set by DACA, the executive order signed by President Obama in 2012. It allows so-called dreamers, the children of undocumented immigrants, to stay and work while they pursue citizenship or green cards. Ernesto applied for a green card 16 years ago, but still doesn't have one. That means if the U.S. Supreme Court invalidates Obama's executive order, Ernesto could be sent back to Mexico, a place he no longer considers home.
I don't remember the names. I remember the faces. I don't remember certain individuals. I don't remember certain places anymore unless I see a picture or a video. And so, yes, I remember remotely doing some of those things in Mexico, but the majority of my life now has been in the United States.
So you're here, quote unquote, legally because of your DACA status.
Right.
But as we all know, given the debate at the federal level, I mean, that can go any number of different ways.
Correct.
Right? So are you anxious about all that?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I think the DACA recipients community will tell you there's a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of uncertainty, and there's definitely fear. Fear of the program being taken away. Fear that the next year there's no DACA, and I find myself with no authorization for employment. Now what? I wouldn't be able to work for the city or anywhere else.
If all the undocumented immigrants living in Dodge were suddenly deported, De La Rosa says it could cripple the local meatpacking plants.
The processing plants would tell you that they rely for the most part on the Latino community for their labor. If a raid were to happen, just like it happened in Mississippi, on both plants, you're talking suddenly hundreds of employees now gone.
New fears in immigrant communities this morning after huge ICE raids in several Mississippi cities.
Handcuffed hundreds of immigrant workers and loaded them onto buses as co-workers and family members.
The massive raid involves several hundred federal ICE agents who surrounded the perimeters of at least seven food processing
facilities.
Charisse
Teban is the outgoing city manager of Dodge. She says the town's cultural transformation wasn't always smooth. There were Latino gang problems for a while that gave Dodge a rougher reputation than, say, Garden City. But she says those and other issues are pretty much in the past.
When the plants first opened, the workforce tended to be very transient. They would come in and work for a year or 2 years and take their money and go to a different community and open a business. And then, so you saw a ton of rental properties that were often left pretty sad shape. And now I think the population's much more stable. They're far less transient. And they're buying those rental properties and owning those homes and taking pride in those homes.
Alejandro Rango Lopez graduated from Dodge City High School last year. He's now attending the University of Kansas, but plans to come back when he graduates. His family arrived in Dodge in the 1990s. And he says while relations between the factions have improved, there's still work to be done.
As far as living and interacting with each other, you know, white, Hispanic, black, immigrant populations are getting along. But my feeling toward this whole thing is, as long as people aren't feeling empowered enough to be represented in elected office, then we're not fully integrated and we're not at the place where we should be.
Arango Lopez says Latinos need to have a greater voice in local affairs. They're underrepresented in government and other leadership positions.
I think the solution has to come from people, from minorities, and from leaders in those communities standing up and running for office and being more vocal about issues that they care about.
Joanne Knight runs the Economic Development Office for Dodge City and Ford County. She's been at it for nearly 30 years. And like many of the community's white leaders, she says whatever tensions existed early in the city's transformation have dissipated. Most people, she says, get that immigrant labor and the meatpacking industry are keeping the town alive.
Oh, it's huge. We know that they are our largest industry. We do have a lot of smaller manufacturers and tourism and some of those other things to fall back on, but they would not keep this community totally afloat. I mean, we are definitely dependent. There are so many trucking companies and service companies and, you know, so many value-added related companies that it would definitely be a huge hit on this whole state if something happened to it. So,
but of course, something could happen to it. American consumers could come to prefer fake meat produced in labs to the real thing. Or automation could someday replace the workers in bloody aprons who slaughter and slice cattle into various cuts of meat to be packaged neatly for the grocery aisle. In a story for Harvest Public Media a few years ago, reporter Luke Runyon said that JBS, the world's largest meatpacking company, was working to perfect that technology.
And while robots have revolutionized the manufacturing industry, meat packers have stubbornly held on to workers. But that could be changing. Late this fall, JBS bought a controlling share of Scott Technology, a New Zealand-based robotics firm.
This is a very innovative and exciting company that we invested in, and we're excited to see what they come up with.
That's JBS spokesman Cameron Brewitt. He says the world's largest meat packer is looking at how robots could fit into their lamb and pork plants first. Sheep and pigs tend to be more uniform than beef cattle.
Now, when it comes to beef packing, beef processing, the fabrication of the animal, it's very difficult to automate beef processing.
The meatpacking robots of today use vision technology to slice and dice. But the key to butchery is touch, not sight. And the company's beef division president, Bill Rupp, says right now robots just can't feel how deep a bone is or expertly remove a filet mignon.
When you get into that detailed, skilled cutting, robots aren't there yet. Someday I'm sure they will be.
The loss of meatpacking jobs would devastate the economy in Dodge. But Joanne Knight says the town has other things going for it. In addition to the projects aimed at boosting tourism, Dodge has an ongoing source of money to spend on making it a nicer place to visit and live.
I don't know what we would be like if we wouldn't have passed that entertainment sales tax, because it has truly improved the quality of life here, given our residents something to do.
Voters approved a permanent sales tax increase in 1997. So far, the proceeds have funded the renovation of the Civic Center, the construction of a sports complex used for regional tournaments, a combination casino and convention center, and a new water park near downtown.
So that was one of the key things in really pushing that issue and getting it approved. And it's brought a lot of positive to our community, but building those public-private partnerships are key.
Joanne has volunteered to drive me around town.
This building here, like I said, closed in the mid-90s.
Mm-hmm. And we start at what used to be the campus of St. Mary's of the Plains, a small college that closed in 1992.
And they have turned it into a nonprofit center. They've taken down quite a few of the old dormitories and stuff that weren't utilizable.
Efforts are now underway to reestablish it as a place for other colleges to hold classes. But the main purpose of the tour is for Knight to show me what Dodge is doing to address a problem that it shares with many other rural communities, a lack of affordable housing. The shortage is so bad that crews regularly load abandoned farmhouses onto trucks and haul them into town to be renovated.
Right on this corner, we have a new duplex that we built, and then one house up is a house that Pride Ag was going to tear down in Jetmore because they needed to expand the elevator. So we moved it from Jetmore here to Dodge, and we already had somebody make an offer on it, and we're having...
After more than an hour of weaving through one housing development after another, Joanne drops me off where we started.
Thanks, Joanne.
You're welcome.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The Boot Hill Distillery is an example of how the community is working to ramp up its tourist trade by capitalizing on its history.
Hard red winter wheat, yellow dent corn, and we have rye in the third one. We haven't started to distill rye yet, but as soon as we're kind of trying to lay down as much bourbon as we can.
Visitors can sample a range of unique spirits in a rustic tasting room, including one inspired by an ad visible in an 1880s photograph of Front Street, a sign hawking a patent medicine called Prickly Ash Bitters. Banned in 1915 during a crackdown on snake oil cure-alls, it's among the distillery's signature products, says marketing director Lee Griffith.
So we did some research. We found the patent, traced it down to a gentleman in Texas. We bought the patent. We had to recreate it as close as possible because there were certain ingredients that we couldn't legally use anymore.
Oh, really? Such as?
One of them was called mayapple root, or from mandrake root. One of them was button snake root. They're considered not generally regarded as safe by the FDA.
I see.
Or potentially carcinogenic. Yeah, there wasn't cocaine or opium.
Right.
I wish that I could add that to the story, but so with the exception it wouldn't
of,
be true.
With the exception of a few ingredients, this is the original recipe.
It is as original as possible,
okay.
Yes.
All
right. So it has prickly ash bark in it, which comes from the prickly ash tree. It was called the toothache tree. You chew on the bark, it numb your mouth in certain quantities.
I see.
But it's also, it's got some gin botanicals. It has juniper, it has coriander, it has orange peel, it has caraway seed, it has chamomile flower, it has allspice in it.
Wow.
It has kind of a menthol wallop, and then you get kind of the orange on the back end, and then you have this taste that sticks with you, which is the numbing effect of the prickly ash bark.
It's interesting. I'm getting this mental picture of somebody with a big cauldron
stirring, just tossing in everything they can think of and stirring it into
double toil and trouble. Yes.
Much like Dodge itself, the new Prickly Ash Bitters harkens to the past, but offers something different. For the booze, it's tamer ingredients. For the city, modern times mean a more complicated mix of commerce and demographics. In an earlier episode, we talked about The Kettle, a combination coffee shop, cafe, and wine bar in Beloit. And we held up the young couple who started it, Bee and Mandy Fincham, as an example of the kind of people a small community needs to thrive even as it shrinks.
And I can't speak for the rest of rural America, but I know Beloit is a special place, and it needed a special place like Kettle.
Well, the Boot Hill Distillery and the farmers backing it are another example of that. So too is the fact that residents of Dodge City, who are pretty conservative politically, saddled themselves with a permanent sales tax increase to pay for community projects. It's a dichotomy that James Fallows found worthy of note in his book.
In national politics and at the state level, Dodge's residents often vote for tax-cutting conservatives. Locally, they pin their city's long-term hopes on a daring tax increase plan. This is known as the Why Not Dodge initiative. Nearly everywhere you look in town, there's another project funded by the ongoing flow of Why Not Dodge revenues.
Remember the research we talked about at Iowa State University, research that says while communities can't do much to reverse generations of population loss, they can continue to thrive. To, as the researchers put it, shrink smartly.
So shrink smart communities are those communities that saw faster than average declines in population, but also had above average gains in quality of life. So if you think about the national narrative that's presented in, you know, on the East and West Coast, everyone thinks that small towns that are shrinking also have falling levels of quality of life. But shrink smart communities are those that are thriving in terms of quality of life.
Unfortunately, shrink smart communities are rare. Of the nearly 100 small Iowa towns surveyed for the study, only 7 were found to be shrinking smartly. That confirms something we probably already knew, that the forces driving population decline, driving the get-big-or-get-out trend in agriculture, are beyond the control of local, even state, policymakers. Still, people like Marcy Panner, she's the director of the Kansas Sampler Foundation, refuse to give up their fight to save rural communities.
So I just think if you're looking for the negative, that's very easy to find. But I'll fight for these towns every day because there are young people moving back. There are good things going on.
Maybe so, but it's hard to ignore what reporter Corey Brown calls the downward trajectory. She's a native Kansan who returned to write a controversial article about why rural Kansas is, quote, dying. She admires the people fighting to save Main Street businesses or to keep a town's only grocery store open, but she fears it's a losing battle.
There were plenty of people who didn't like my story. Okay. And I heard back from them saying, you don't understand. We're fighting the good fight and we're doing fine. That's not doing fine. That's just dying a little slower.
There is, however, a fresh focus on the challenges facing rural Kansas. Lieutenant Governor Lynn Rogers is heading up Governor Laura Kelly's new office of, quote, rural prosperity. And he's working on a set of proposals.
And so that responsibility weighs very heavily on me. And I think I said it at a number of different places and to our staff is, okay, now we have to do something.
A new legislative committee is also working on a rural agenda, though a recent change in its leadership could hinder that work. They won't be the first politicians, of course, offering some sort of plan for the rural plains. And they'll be up against forces that reach far beyond Kansas and that have proven stubborn for a century. But whatever happens, we're going to keep following the story. So check your podcast feeds for updates and give us a review so that more people might listen and then join in the conversation. While you're at it, visit our website, ksnewsservice.org, and subscribe to our newsletter, The Insider. Finally, keep listening to your favorite public radio station for our coverage of the health and well-being of Kansans, their communities, and civic life. For the Kansas News Service and the My Fellow Kansans podcast, I'm Jim McLean.
My
fellow Kansans, comes to us from the Kansas News Service. Thanks to the producers of Season 2, Scott Cannon, Luann Stevens, Beth Golay, and Ben Stanton, and thanks to the host, Jim McLean. That's a wrap for this morning's show on KCUR's Central Standard. You can grab anything you missed at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. And while you're there, you can also sign up to have all these conversations on our show sent right to you so you can listen whenever it's convenient for you. kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, books, the best books you read in 2019. Call and tell us about them or get started now on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. Tomorrow's show is going to be a great chance to jot down some things for your own reading list or maybe even as possible gifts. You won't want to miss it. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell with Mackenzie Martin and Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.